From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. It may not be getting much media coverage here in the U.S., but the nation of Venezuela is in a state of intense crisis. The right-wing U.S.-backed opposition there has, in effect, issued a call for a coup against the elected socialist government of President Nicolas Maduro, miring that South American nation into its worst political and economic crisis since the attempted U.S.-backed coup against then-President Hugo Chavez in April of 2002. Venezuela's socialist government and the right-wing opposition met Sunday to kick off a dialogue that was reportedly aimed at easing tensions. For more on that, we spoke with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo. Tony, welcome back. It's been a while, and we have a lot to talk about.
Yeah, there's a great deal to talk about, and we'll probably only cover a tiny fraction in the next 30 minutes or so.
I think we need to do Venezuela.
Okay.
Because that's not getting covered, and it's you know, that's been the epicenter of the rise of, you know, the movement for sovereignty and integration and peace in Latin America, and most importantly, as an umbrella over that, independence in Latin America. And you've had a number of things that have at least are contradictions and considered setbacks by some, and you know, characterized by the media up here in other ways. But now you have had the beginnings of an actual confrontation between the right and the left, with the right attempting to provoke a constitutional crisis in Venezuela, right, following an apparently successful pushback by the Maduro government, by the socialist government, against the right-wing National Assembly, seizing control or threatening the seizure of control of key things that were used as weapons, economic weapons against the government, right, and more.
Right.
Let's pick that up from the beginning and try to give people an idea of what's going on.
Well, I suppose, from my point of view, as somebody that is familiar with the process that has taken place here in Nicaragua from the revolution in the 80s through the electoral defeat in 1990, and then the recovery of power over the next 15, 16, 17 years by the Frente Sandinista here. Mm-hmm. And when we look at Venezuela, we have a slightly different perspective from people in North America or people in South America or people in Venezuela itself. And so for us, when we look at Venezuela, we look at the election that took place in December 2015, the legislative elections, in which massive abstention by the Chavistas, or people who previously voted Chavista in Venezuela, allowed the Venezuelan right wing to kind of make massive gains, and to the point where they almost got a sufficient majority to change the constitution, which has been denied them as a result of a ruling by the Supreme Court in Venezuela over electoral fraud in three or four places. So, and that really frustrated the Venezuelan right wing. So then they went for the recall referendum, which is a democratic mechanism that allows the people of Venezuela to recall their president halfway through the president's term. but they, for reasons that have to do with their own internal conflicts, they left that too late for the process to be completed in 2016. And that's important, because if they can't complete the recall process in 2016, the authorities in Venezuela are not obliged to call new elections.
Right.
And so what would happen in the event of a recall vote in 2017, if there is one, and it's not at all clear now that there would be one, that there will be one, Nicolas Maduro might be recalled, but then he'd just be substituted by his vice president until the scheduled elections in whenever it is,
2018, right. That's the reason for it. I mean, once you get into 2017, you're almost in 2018, and it's only, let's not have two elections, you know.
Right, exactly, and so that, but the internally in Venezuela, what the government has done since its crushing defeat in the legislative elections in December 2015 is that it's tried to regroup and tried to reform policy and tried to remake policy on all fronts. For example, on the international front, Nicolas Maduro and his colleagues have put an awful lot of work into lobbying with OPEC and non-OPEC oil producers to try and rebuild the oil price to levels that are not catastrophic for the Venezuelan economy and for the economies of, for example, Russia as well. And so what that means is that the oil price has recovered as a result of those efforts among oil producers, and that's given some respite to the Venezuelan economy. And also domestically, in the internal Venezuelan economy, domestically, the government's taken various steps to combat the systematic economic sabotage that's been taking place as a result of very deliberate decisions and very well-coordinated policies by Venezuela's political right wing and the economic forces in Venezuela that support the extreme right wing. And now they've been completely frustrated on that economic front.
Right. Particularly the supply chain lines of, that's where they were choking the supply lines of distribution of goods, and also those things that are produced locally, they likewise were interfering with the delivery to market. And that the government took the initiative finally over the last months and said, look, you don't deliver it, we're going to come get it and deliver it ourselves. And that's what's happened.
Yeah, and the government has also on there's so many different fronts on which the government has had to act in order to combat this systematic sabotage. And one of them, of course, is the contraband front all along the Colombian frontier. Yeah. And so they, for a long time, they closed the Colombian frontier, and they took measures to try and control the smuggling of fuel from Venezuela, and fuel especially, but also foodstuffs from Venezuela into Colombia, because in Venezuela the petrol prices are heavily subsidized, and that means that there's a huge markup and a fantastic markup for smugglers who are able to smuggle large quantities of fuel into Colombia.
Now, let's remember we're talking about Colombia, by the way, folks. So those things that get shipped into Colombia, gee, maybe they could hide barrels of oil in a shipping container full of cocaine, for example, to get it into the United States. So you buy it for 2 cents a gallon in Venezuela, and you sell it for $2.50 a gallon in the U.S.
Yeah, and the fuel smuggling is a huge problem. And it's something that sooner or later Nicolas Maduro and his colleagues are going to have to do something about. They have to bring the oil price, bring the fuel price in Venezuela to a sensible level. Right. You know, and because it's way below what anybody is paying anywhere else in Latin America.
Right.
So anyway, there are all kinds of issues like that that need dealing with. So on the economic front, the government has recouped its position both domestically and internationally. On the political front, it's managed to, it's actually used in the same way that Brazil and Argentina, the right-wing governments are using their control of the legal system to attack left-wing progressive leaders like Lula da Silva and Cristina Kirchner in Brazil and Argentina, respectively, in the same way that the justice system is being used, the control of the justice system is being used by the right wing in those countries.
Yeah.
In Venezuela, and the Chavista control of the justice system in Venezuela is being used to defend the Bolivarian Revolution, quite legitimately, and wholly legitimately, you know. And so
that's not what you read in the New York Times, though. It looks like the opposite for some reason up here in Disneyland.
Well, of course, because they're not getting what they want.
Right.
So whereas they keep very quiet about really egregious abuses that even the United Nations has condemned in the case of Argentina, where you have this very progressive labor and indigenous peoples activist Milagro Sala unjustly imprisoned by the Argentinian justice system at the behest of the right-wing government. You hear nothing about that in the corporate media in North America and Western Europe.
Who?
Milagro Sala.
Who?
Right, exactly. You're right. Sorry, I didn't catch that.
That's okay.
So then, and what's happening in Venezuela, by contrast, is a perfectly legitimate. They're not making an illegitimate use of the justice system to go after, and they could do. And if they use the same criteria as the Brazilian authorities and the Argentinian authorities, they could lock up most of the Venezuelan opposition on grounds of sedition and treason.
That's right.
You know, but they don't do that. They adopt a very moderate position whereby they use their control, they take advantage of their control of the justice system to defend the recall process against abuse by the right wing.
Right.
Because the right wing were trying to force through a recall referendum while dismissing due process, the whole process that recall referendum requires, which requires the collection of signatures, the verification of the signatures, and so forth. And currently, the whole recall process has been suspended, precisely because the opposition has been caught out trying to introduce fraudulent signatures into the recall process.
Right.
And so the justice system in Venezuela has suspended the recall process pending investigation of four or five cases of fraudulent collection of signatures.
Right, which is the way they play it anywhere. I mean, in the United States, I've seen that happen in local elections all around me, and I've been thrown off the ballot myself three different times.
Right. So you're well aware of
I've litigated this stuff. I know how it works. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So that's where the recall process stands. And in general, stepping back, looking at the situation in Venezuela from here in Nicaragua, what it looks like is that the Venezuelan authorities were shocked by their defeat in December, tried to force their way through the crisis in the first 3 or 4 months of 2016, realized that wasn't going to work and was counterproductive, reassessed everything, and now they're on track to survive the recall referendum if it's eventually held, and actually recover political power in the legislature in the 2018 elections.
Right. You know, let's back out even more. Look at you have the empire 2 years ago looking at the rise of BRICS, the consolidation of independent states in Latin America and the Caribbean, reconfigurations happening across the Middle East in some ways, and in Asia, certainly more so, and that's been developing right up through the Philippines, for example. And so you have this pushback that they characterize, the American, the U.S. media characterizes in Latin America as a conservative revival, but is really like a coordinated blitzkrieg of attempted retrenchment. And across the board, one of the weapons that they used was the drive down of commodity prices to impoverish the producers, which many of these countries are, including Russia and Iran and Venezuela. And so now you see part of the defense is, an attempt to reconfigure the power centers of decision-making in the setting of commodity prices in the marketplace, and also one of the mistakes I think they made was that while they were doing that, they drove the biggest producers and the biggest consumer into the same enemy camp. And so you have Well, you saw manifest when they sanctioned Russia, for example, China turning around and signing the largest business deal in history with Russia over commodities, over oil and gas. You have sort of the same macro game going on right now, and it hasn't manifested itself yet in, say, China building factories in Venezuela, but the tendencies all lie in that direction. What do you think that means, like, you know, looking at the landscape in Latin America? But, well, let's say begin with Venezuela.
Well, I think in general in Latin America, it's very clear that the United States is not going to recover the trade and economic primacy that it enjoyed prior to the China's arrival on the scene as the biggest trade partner of Brazil, for example, and it's on its way to being the biggest trade partner for Mexico,
right,
which is right next door to the United States and a member of NAFTA.
A NAFTA partner, right.
So, and from Venezuela's point of view, and they continue to be an important oil supplier to the United States despite everything.
Yep.
And so, but they've also struck very important deals, trade deals, involving the sale of oil to China, but also all kinds of investment deals that China's signed and is carrying out with Venezuela. And so, and it's from the point of view of, you know, what is going to happen to the oil price and what is going to be the nature of the oil market with regard to Venezuela's enormous oil resources, but they're a very heavy oil that is requires a lot of money to extract.
Mm-hmm.
So, and what that kind of effect is going to have on Venezuela's economy and its economic profile in years to come is still, and I think the jury's still out on that, but one important thing that has happened is that when Nicolas Maduro presented this year's budget to the Venezuelan people, and ratified by the Supreme Court of Justice because of various problems to do with the constitutionality of the behavior of the National Assembly. When he presented that budget, only 30% of it depended on oil revenues.
It's remarkable.
Which is a huge turnaround in just a year.
Yeah, under those conditions. Political and economic.
Yeah. So, and what that means is that the Venezuelan authorities are very well aware that they can no longer depend on the price of oil, and that they're always going to be subject to ambushes in the international oil market by the United States authorities and the corporate elites that use the United States authorities for their own geopolitical ends.
Right. More specifically, them. Yeah.
And so, so what that means is that in Latin American terms, and Venezuela is going to reorient its economy, and that means that it should still remain. And so much depends on what happens in the 2018 elections, doesn't it? But for the next 2 years, at least, it's going to still remain an extremely important driver of the Caribbean economy through Petrocaribe,
right,
because of the agreements that Venezuela has maintained with the 19 countries, I think it's 19 countries that make up Petrocaribe, that give enormous stability to those countries. So say, for example, the oil price suddenly shoots up again because of the volatility in the market driven by who knows what factors,
right,
including speculation.
Mm.
And those countries will be able to manage those. What Petrocaribe, driven by Venezuela, has done is it has enabled all those countries to manage the volatility of the oil market so that their own economies are not disrupted by these volatile changes in the oil price.
That's right.
And so, and what that Venezuela is going to continue to be, is going to continue to contribute enormous stability to the region in that sense, despite all the ridiculous rhetoric coming out of the U.S. State Department that Venezuela destabilizes the region. And who's destabilizing the region? Colombia has been destabilizing the region for years because
of
its
civil war.
Its civil war and its It's narcotics activity,
right,
entrenched for years and protected for years by Alvaro Uribe.
And the United States.
And the United States. And of course, and Mexico is also a factor that destabilizes the region because of the huge instability internally in Mexico. But then the other thing that's going on, of course, and something that we should try and talk about if you've still got time, is...
Yeah, we've got time.
The Venezuela's role within Mercosur and the way that the Brazilian, Argentinian and Paraguayan governments, dominated by, for the most part, spurious right-wing regimes, and the Paraguayan government came to power in the wake of a constitutional coup against Fernando Lugo.
Right.
The Mauricio Macri's government came to power on the basis of barefaced lies to the Argentinian people, are now up in arms against the policies that Macri has imposed on them.
Right, and also the backdrop of that economic warfare we were talking about, because Argentina had serious economic issues that were affecting the people that were a consequence of that same international scenario that was pushing down the economies of the whole region.
Yes, and which also affected Brazil, of course. I mean, we all know what's happened in Brazil.
I'm
not sure about the results of the second round of the municipal elections. It looks as though a progressive leader may have succeeded in holding on to Rio de Janeiro, but until I see the full results, it's difficult to talk about what political message those municipal elections reflect nationally, although it doesn't look good for the Workers' Party for all kinds of reasons that perhaps we can talk about another time. But the main thing about the Brazil and Argentina and Paraguay's relationship with Venezuela is, of course, that they're trying to shove Venezuela out of Mercosur.
Right.
At the time when Bolivia is trying to enter Mercosur. Bolivia, the process for Bolivia's integration into Mercosur depends on votes in the various parliaments of Brazil, Uruguay, Paraguay, Argentina, and a decision by the Venezuelan government, of course. But what does that mean? I mean, why should anybody care about whether Venezuela is in or out of Mercosur? I mean, the fundamental issue is what kind of integration the region is going to undergo. Is it going to undergo a kind of progressive solidarity-based integration based on progressive ideas that have made the ALBA countries so successful? And if you look at who are the countries in the region that have done best economically over the last 10, 15 years, the ALBA countries,
for sure,
and one or two others, for different reasons. But overall, it's been proven, and the Economic Commission for Latin America and the Caribbean of the United Nations confirms this. It's been demonstrated that the socialist-inspired policies of the ALBA countries have been more successful than the ridiculous zombie trickle-down economics, neoliberal economics,
looting,
applied in right-wing governments, what's going on in Mercosur with Brazil and Argentina, in particular, trying to marginalize Venezuela, is that they want to impose the kind of in inverted commas free trade ideology, this neoliberal ideology that was originally the philosophy behind the free trade area of the Americas, pushed by George W. Bush in his time, that was completely defeated by a combination of various progressive leaders, including Lula da Silva, which is one of the reasons that he's under attack in Brazil by the authorities there, the right-wing authorities. But the importance of Venezuela's situation for the region is absolutely key. Venezuela, the survival of the Bolivarian Revolution in Venezuela is really fundamental to what kind of integration the region is going to be able to experience over the next 5 to 10 years. And that is why the right wing, this so-called right wing restoration or right wing revival, is not an expression of self-assurance and dominance by the right wing, but rather an expression of desperation. Because if they can't entrench themselves, as you put it, and consolidate their illegitimate power in countries like Argentina and Brazil, which are absolutely key. Brazil is by far the biggest economy in the region, right, even rivaling the United States, and in some sense.
Yeah.
So, and if the right wing can't entrench their power over the next couple of years, then it's likely that the influence of China, the BRICS countries, the dissipation of U.S. power, the evaporation of U.S. influence over the next 3 to 5 years, which is going to happen. There's no way it's not going to happen. And it doesn't matter who becomes president.
That's right.
The decline of U.S. power and influence is, I don't like using the word inevitable.
It's
but
structural. Part of the design.
Yeah. So, and what that means is that if the right wing can't consolidate their power in the region over the next couple of years, then the model for integration that's likely to be developed is going to look more like the kind of development favored by the ALDE country, which is in favor of the dispossessed majorities and not in favor of a tiny elite. And if you want to kind of reduce it down even further in theoretical terms, what you're actually talking about is this global conflict between a ruthless tiny elite who'll do anything and commit any crime to defend their power and privilege and control and influence and status, and the great majority of the world who just want a basically decent life.
You know, if you just take two images to describe the competing models here, and one is the image that, you know, you could find a century of photographs of it, so you don't have to conjure it up yourself. Basically, we're coming in and we're taking your stuff, your oil, gas, minerals, food, whatever, and you're going to gather it for us at gunpoint. That's one model. And the other is people sitting around a table and working out a collaborative plan of development and then looking abroad for partners to help invest in it. And that is the choice that is being presented to the people there. And of course, it's not a choice.
Well, and that has been the history of Latin America over the last 500 and more years.
Yeah.
Hasn't it? And the people at grassroots have always been repressed and oppressed by their local elites and the global elites that control and manipulate local regional players. And over the last, ever since the Cuban Revolution, there's been a different, you know, there has been an alternative, and a much more attractive alternative.
Yep.
And over the last 50 years, and the Cuban Revolution managed to survive, thank heaven.
Mm-hmm.
And that made it possible for individuals like Hugo Chavez, right, for Daniel Ortega and his Sandinista colleagues, for Evo Morales in Bolivia, and even for Rafael Correa, who's much more middle of the road, and to develop socialist-inspired alternatives, those over the last 15 years. And those are not going to go away. People never have tasted what a decent life feels like, and what it's like to be treated as though you are a person.
Right.
You know, and then they're not going to let that go. You know, and I don't see how the right wing are going to be able to sustain what passes for their political project in the face of the accumulated experience of the last, in specifically of the last 20 years, but also they're up against this enormous longing for emancipation that is based on the accumulated experience of centuries.
That's right. And on that note, we'll have to stop here. Tony, thank you very much. A pleasure as always.
Okay, thanks a million, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.